From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with actress Colleen Dewhurst. She plays Eugene O'Neill's widow in the one-person show My Jean. Also today, I talk with rock musician, singer, and songwriter Marshall Crenshaw. He draws on musical influences as diverse as Buddy Holly and the MC5, but when he writes his own songs, he hopes they'll sound like no other. Ken Tucker reviews what's new in home video, and guitarist Bob Brosman performs a couple of songs on the steel guitar. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. In a few seconds, you will hear one of the most intriguing, husky voices of the stage or screen. My guest is actress Colleen Dewhurst. Some of her films include Annie Hall, The Dead Zone, and The Nun Story. This year, she won an Emmy Award for her performance in the made-for-TV movie Between Two Women, which co-starred Farrah Fawcett as her daughter-in-law. For years, Dewhurst acted primarily in the theater. She's considered one of the preeminent interpreters of playwright Eugene O'Neill. Recently, she has been touring in a one-person show about O'Neill called My Jean. She plays O'Neill's widow, Carlotta Monterey, who is institutionalized in the mental ward of a New York hospital where she is remembering her stormy relationship with O'Neill. Colleen Dewhurst, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You've played in a lot of O'Neill's plays, and
yes.
Now you're playing the role of his widow. Is playing a woman in his life at all similar to playing a woman that he wrote about?
I never thought of it that way. I guess, yes, it is, because I think that the wonderful thing about O'Neill women is the fact that O'Neill always insists that you go all the way. He won't... I've always said that if you try to get safe with O'Neill, it becomes melodrama and becomes embarrassing. So you have to take the chance. That's where Jose Quintero was so wonderful. You have to take the chance and go down to the bottom of the pit and
Of chance specifically are we talking about here?
I suppose it's what I call a stripping, a removal of the mask. In other words, I feel that we're... And it's funny because O'Neill used masks in some of his early plays. And I think it's the thing that we're all masked pretty well for each occasion. I mean, in other words, we could say that you and I both have on the mask for this occasion, whatever we're bringing to it and have decided is the proper attitude and way that we will behave during this, unless something throws us. And I think we spend a lot of time watching people to see when the mask slips. And you see under there, you know, you're talking to someone who seems perfectly all right and fine, and you'll see that slip and you'll realize that you're looking into eyes or something that are suffering through, and then the mask comes back up. And I think with Carlotta, without realizing it until you said that, that it's true again in Carlotta, the demand is made that the woman strip down sometimes to what is what I call bare knuckle, and then the pulling together again. But, of course, she is more vulnerable because the mind is not always in control.
You're acting in a one-person show now. I guess the pleasures of acting alone on stage must be pretty different than those of acting with an ensemble.
I think pleasure is a word that I... pleasure in acting is that wonderful feeling of coming on stage one night and two of you looking at each other and knowing that you've got it, that you're on, that it's moving and that it's right and everything. And of... having that energy coming back to you that can... But in this case, I'd said one time, Barbara got very upset because I'd given an interview before we opened saying that this was the worst experience of my life. And that Zoe had said to me, who had done Lillian Hellman, and she said to me, oh, you're going to hate it, darling. It is just awful up there, just awful. I said, after I began rehearsing, I was just going to call her up and scream into the phone and hang up, and she'd know who was calling. But it is, it's just a, Because it's a self-generated energy. And you have nowhere to get energy from. You eventually, I believe, are, but it'll take a while, are eventually taking energy from the house. But it's not, people say, well, you know, why wouldn't you? And I said, if you really look at other one-person shows, they usually, 99% of them are people who speak to the house at intervals, who will turn and make a...
an aside.
That's right, to them or look right at them and laugh or do whatever they're going to do. Now, that is relaxing. They have now, but you're playing with the four walls. There is no way that you can, how shall I say, ask them to like you. You can't, you're up there entirely dependent upon your script and your own energy level.
You know, for years you worked primarily in theater, and then you started doing more movie roles. You've been doing more television now as well. You got an Emmy Award this year for your performance in that made-for-TV movie. Was it a conscious decision for you to get more into television and movies? Is that something that you'd been wanting to do?
Well, no. I mean, people used to ask me years ago, why had I chosen not to do film? I'd go, oh, no, no. It sounded so kind of wonderfully altruistic, as if I'd said, no, no, the theater is my work. I said, anyhow, I'm on the first plane out of here if someone would ask me to do a film. And then I did films I would do. I did a lot of, when I began in TV, it was in things that were the play of the week on public television with Seth Kind and Eli Landau. And I literally, that was the day of the live show. And when I finally began to get some live television, I became known as the person who closed every show. They'd announced that no longer would they have a live show in New York, and I'd finally get a job on it. I would do that show, and that was the end of that show. The U.S. Steel Hour, the this, the that. And then I never really got much. Here and there I would get something. And then I think pretty late on I began to do television and television film, and then I began to get some film. But it wasn't steady, and I think the truth was, too, that people think you made the choice because you wish to always pick something that was good. And as my sons say, I never watch anything I do. I can come into the house and walk past them and realize they're watching a show I'm on, and one of them will say, I say, oh, how's that going? I go, this one was for the money, right, Mom? I'm in this one.
You don't watch any movies that you're in?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. I did, years ago I watched Play of the Week, and then I'd get very upset. And someone had said to me, you shouldn't really watch anything you do, Colleen, because you're obviously too subjective, not objective enough. And I think probably also, in analyzing it, there's a feminine thing that's in there that you're looking at yourself. Sometimes I'd go, what is she doing? Come on, come on. What is happening here? And but I'd also, another part of me would be looking at how I looked. I'd be going, oh, I don't know. I don't look so good there. I don't look...
And you can't afford to be self-conscious when you're acting.
No, and I didn't want to fall into a trap of... I mean, you want to look good. Of course you want to look good. But I didn't want to fall into a trap of that being a concern of mine when I was in front of a camera. I don't want to be concerned about any of the technical thing that is going on around me. I think that... I know actors who are great actors who can... who know just what the camera is doing and just what is happening, and it doesn't affect them at all. I think you have to analyze why, for you, that is not good. I mean, I'm playing for the crew. I mean, as if they were out there watching it, right? Instead of, you learn all the professional things, how to hit your marks and what to do.
You know, one of your movie roles that I really loved was in Annie Hall, where you played Diane Keaton's mother.
Yeah.
And in the movie, for our listeners who have seen it, you are cast as the kind of prototypical goyim. You know,
absolutely.
Because there's a great scene where everyone's around the table eating, and Woody Allen, looking at you, is imagining himself as an Orthodox Jew with payas and a yarmulke on, because you're so non-Jewish to him. How did he cast you for that role? Is that did he really think of you as the prototypical
non-Jew? I don't know.
Non-Jew?
The funny thing is that Woody, everybody, I went up very high in the estimation of my children when I did that film. But I was doing Moon for the Misbegotten, and Woody had come there, and he would just kind of wander up and stare in the dressing room door and then leave. And then about the second time he came up, Ned Flanders was dressing next to me, and he came up and kind of looked in the door and said who he was. And I went, yes, I know, and he just kind of nodded. And I thought, and Ed said to me, wasn't that Woody Allen? I said, yes. I said, he was here a couple of weeks ago. So about a year passed, I think, and I was doing Virginia Woolf. And suddenly he came backstage and said, did I, you know, what did I think about doing a movie or something? But it was kind of a mumble, and I went, well, I, wow. So then I was sent kind of pieces of paper with dialogue on them.
Well, scraps of paper?
Yes, I mean, it's just kind of a, you know, an idea for a character. And you weren't allowed to see the script, and you didn't know anybody else that was playing in it.
Why?
That was the way he wanted it. I mean, I didn't know who was playing my husband or who was playing anything the day I was taken out in the car to New Jersey and entered a house and...
God, you describe it as if you're being kidnapped.
And, I know, and was introduced around and kind of, and I thought, and I myself thought it was odd that he picked me as kind of, I mean, what I saw, because I hadn't read any script and I never saw the movie, was that kind of the perfect Englewood, New Jersey, white wasp woman and her children and everybody. I thought, it's very strange, but it's interesting what someone's view, especially if you consider that what he was seeing in me, that he had been to a Moon for the Misbegotten, like three times he'd seen this Irish farm woman. But, and I think what he did, I mean, there were a lot, there was Jerry, Maureen, after that, you know, it was like there were several of us of that group that he just reached in and would pick out at certain times and put you in.
I want to ask you about another movie, and this is much earlier in your career, and I'm thinking of The Nun Story. And you were on camera it's a very small role, but that role has haunted me. I remember seeing that when I was a child, and I'm thinking of the scene, Audrey Hepburn plays the nun,
right.
And she's working at a mental institution. And she walks in to take care of someone who's supposed to be violent, but she's very subdued now. Mm-hmm. You're that patient. And you just kind of, as I remember it, just like rise up and try to kill mm-hmm. her. You tear the habit off of her head. And it's a terrifying, terrifying scene. As a matter of fact, I looked
that
it up.
That was the first film I ever
was
did.
Was it the first film?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I looked it up in Leonard Maltin's Guide to TV Movies today, and it's a little two-line thing, and he mentions you in one of those two lines. You know, he says, Colleen Dewhurst as a homicidal patient is electrifying. And there's no room for him to say this in that little capsule, believe me. But I want to ask you about how you did that role, because it was so... electrifying is a good word, and such as your first role, a small role?
I don't know. I just, that was a very exciting year for me. And I'd gone in to see Fred Zinnemann, who I did know who he was, and then she had, and he didn't say what role. Again, someone who sits and looks at you, right? Just stares at you. And then my agent called and said, well, you have the part? I said, what part is it? And she said, it's the archangel. I was waiting to play the nuns. I mean, everybody was playing a nun. I thought, every actress wants to play a nun or a whore, right? Those are always parts you want to play. And I said, the archangel Gabriel, what is that? And I'm getting the book, trying to read it and find out. And I loved when I went over there because it was the first, my first time in Europe. And to go to Rome, I mean, mm-hmm. I was hysterical. And I landed at this hotel with several wonderful actresses all talking, and I never forgot. One of them said, an American, they were American and British. She said, I don't know what it, they say that Zinnemann is able to judge you by your face, what he sees in your face. And she said, and I'm the only mean nun. She said, so I don't know what that means. So there was kind of a pause, and I went, well, I know, but you're all playing nuns, and I'm playing someone who is schizophrenic and crazy out of her mind, right? But when I went in, they asked me, they had arranged for me to go to an insane asylum, and I said, no, I didn't wish to do that.
To do research.
And I said, well, you just have to trust me. I said, I really don't want to. So I remember they came in and they had a specialist there, of course, and everything, an Italian who was wonderful. So the first was, I can remember still, was catatonic. And I remembered entering the cell, which wasn't. And he said, Fred said to me, is there anything that... I said, no, just actually lock the door. And he went, okay, we'll lock the door. So we locked the door, and that was the way they started the first one. The other thing I remember him saying was, coming up and saying, now listen, Colleen, Audrey is a very frail woman. I went, okay. I realized, I thought, in those days, I was considered a really tall,
right.
big girl. Back in those days, there weren't women who were 5'8". Acting in film. I suppose I looked like I could kill her. But I loved doing it.
It was a great performance. I want to talk to you more about your work on stage and screen, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Colleen Dewhurst, and she's currently performing in Philadelphia in a one-person show called My Jean, and she plays the role of Eugene O'Neill's widow. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Actress Colleen Dewhurst is my guest. You just said that when you were working in the nun store that you were considered very big then. You're very tall. You're not considered tall now? Have standards changed for women actresses? For women actresses. Redundant. But have standards changed for women?
I think when I was in my 20s, I think everywhere I went, they'd speak of how tall I was. In fact, I really got started in playing women who were, I was always playing the woman who was leading the army in Shakespeare or ate her children in a pie or broke up the family or something. And I just, I realized suddenly that I was, I think one of my first big breaks was in Ballad of the Sad Cafe that Edward Albee attained, which was this big woman. And then, of course, the big break was Moon for the Misbegotten, which was another oversized woman. And then I've noticed that maybe in the last 10 years, suddenly there are very tall women out there that 5'8" is not considered terribly tall or terribly big. But for a while there, I would not, when I began to break through, I would not be hired because the leading man was not tall.
We know what I'm thinking, too. You have very strong facial features, and it looks, you look like a strong woman. You look physically strong and emotionally strong, and it would be hard for you to play the kind of frail, vulnerable leading lady. You know, and there have been periods where leading ladies have been that way.
Well, I think probably it was that I was never an ingenue. I could never, in other words, entering New York, I think, when I was 20. And everybody in that age span that was coming in that was were ingenues. And I remember saying to Joe Papp one time, he hadn't seen me, and it was when he was first starting, and he just called me on the phone and said that his wife had seen me in a class and thought I would, that he was going to do Romeo and Juliet. He had taken a small church down on 6th Avenue and 6th Street, and I went, "You've never seen me, have you?" And I said, "No." I said, "Well, I couldn't do Juliet when I was 12. I knew by that. I knew nothing about my voice or anything. Only when I hit into New York did people begin to pick out characteristics about you in a class. They would mention something, right?
Well, I think your voice is one of the most striking things about your performances. You have such a wonderful voice, and its huskiness has so much a kind of character in it and a certain even mystery to it. Have you worked to develop your voice at all?
No, I would always, every once in a while, I'll see someone commenting on the voice, and I'll hear something about whiskey. They'll have a whiskey will come in there, whiskey something tone voice, or cigarette. And finally, one time I said to somebody, you know, I said, "I have to tell you that when I was in sixth grade, because I can remember it vividly, I said, each class, I said, had to do a country, and our country was Russia. And I was very excited because all our little group was doing were the boys and the girls together were singing a Russian song, which went, "Eugnem, Eugnem." And the day came, and my mom and dad were coming that night and everything, and I had my little Russian dress. And so in came the music teacher. And she said, and the girls sang first, and then she said, she did the girls, and then she went, "There's something wrong on the girls' side." And she said, "Girls, will you go again?" And so all the girls were going, "Eugnem." And in the middle was me going, "Eugnem." And she went, "What is your name?" And I said, "My name's Colleen." She said, "Colleen, tonight, just mouth it."
So you had a deep voice, even
yes,
then.
I obviously, but I never was conscious of. My sons used to laugh because when I would call home, collect, and one of them would pick up the phone, they'd say, "We have a collect call for anyone from a Mr. Dewhurst." And there'd be a pause, and I'd go, "Yes, I'll accept it. Hi, Mom." There is no Mr. Dewhurst.
You know, I think we usually think of actors as being bodies. We usually think of them physically. But with someone like you, you really think of the voice, too, because your voice is that striking. I think, you know, for a lot of actors, the first thing you think of is their face or how they look. And with you, like, the voice is there, right? Right there with how you look.
It's very strange. It really is, because as time goes on, you will hear more and more people. Things happen through the years, and you don't realize they're happening because you're not paying any attention to the fact that time is going and that now definition is coming.
You know, I should mention, people said, "Oh, it's a whiskey voice." No, it's a cigarette voice. You do smoke cigarettes.
Yes.
Have you tried to stop or anything because of your career on stage or life in general?
No, I think I've three or four times I've tried to stop for reasons which probably more involve sons.
Uh-huh.
You know, that they get tense, and I can understand that. Yes, it would be your fault if you were to go before time, so to speak.
You have two sons?
Yes, two boys.
And it's very hard, and it was especially more difficult when you were a young mother than it probably is now. It's been very hard to have a career and raise a family at the same time. And you once said that you felt in a way you owed your career to your housekeeper, who mm-hmm. helped you keep things together, helped
Nana, yes.
helped you with your moves, helped you with your children. And I thought that was a really interesting thing to say.
She was wonderful. She was really terrific. And I was lucky because I didn't have the children when I was young. And I don't know what I would have done when I look at, you know, actresses or women who are even now my son's wife, who is a very, very bright gal who has had two children very quickly. And I know that mentally she is ready to go out, you know, to begin either a law career or something. And yet I understand their reasoning, which is to have it done early, have the children, and then to be able to have the life. But I was lucky because my my then husband, who I had married, he had a career that was moving, so that there was not worry on...
Was this George C. Scott?
Yes, not worry on the financial area. And Nana came with me before I had Alex. I was pregnant, but... And I realized it was wonderful because I was working in theater. Some people will say, well, that I gave up. Every once in a while I'll see an article saying that because of being married and having children that I missed a big part of my career, and that's why I was... That's not true, because I was still working. I was working for, like, Joe
Papp.
And working for Jose and Ted down at the Circle. But the wonderful thing was that the boys were only 11 months apart, much to my shock and surprise. So it was like having twins. But you could put them to bed at night. And then you went to the theater, and then at 6:30 and 7 in the morning, you were still there. So they had no... So all during the growing up period, I really was more home than away. It really was only in the last 10 years that I've really been flying out to places and staying. I'd never stay more than 2 weeks away from them, and if it was going to be more, then I carried them. I took them with me.
You made a little joke before about taking roles that you're offered. Do you take what you're offered, or do you turn down roles that you don't...
In the theater, I turned down. But quite honestly, in film and television, there was a period there where... I'll have a couple of periods where I took roles that paid very well, but that I wasn't... I think I always say the dangerous thing is to take something and then try to make believe. I mean, when you get on that plane for California, you cannot sit there and say to someone, I've had it said to me, well, of course, you know, this isn't really... the script isn't terribly good, but I feel there is something in the part that I want to go, oh, come on. We're flying out there for the money. They're paying you for fast. They figure you'll study, that you'll go to bed at night and that you'll be there on time and that you're not going to make a fuss or worry about your hair or anything, that you'll be on the set. You'll know your lines and you may try to make it look like more than a cardboard cutout of a woman. But there's been a couple of years now that I've played for TV that I've really, really loved the experience.
And you want to do more of it?
Oh, yes. Which I, you know, it's an entirely different discipline. But it's, I like it now. I mean, there are certain roles that I'm really proud of now. And it's always interesting because when people speak to you, because many people across the country only know you from film, they will always mention the same women.
Which ones?
Well, there was a movie I did called And Baby Makes Six, and they insist on that one. The Woman's Room, Anne of Green Gables, Between Two Women, always the same. And always, interestingly enough, women who are of a certain age who are viable.
Well, I love your acting, and it's been wonderful to have you here. I thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
My guest has been actress Colleen Dewhurst, and in Philadelphia, she's currently starring in the Joe Papp production My Jean, a one-woman show about Eugene O'Neill's widow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶ From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I talk with rock guitarist, singer, and songwriter Marshall Crenshaw. Even if you don't know his music, you might remember his portrayal of Buddy Holly in the film La Bamba. Also today, guitarist Bob Brosman performs two songs from the 20s on his National Steel guitar. And Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of a concert of children's songs by singer Raffi. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt in Washington. President Reagan today dismissed Douglas Ginsburg's revelation that he smoked marijuana in the 60s and 70s, saying, "I'm sure there were a great many people who did that." He said he would stand behind his nominee to the Supreme Court. But Senate Majority Leader Robert Byrd said he's concerned about the image this presents to young people. Byrd said Ginsburg should consider withdrawing his name. Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd echoed the statements of many lawmakers today, saying he would not pass judgment until the Senate Judiciary Committee completes its hearings.
It's getting more bizarre every day. I don't have any real comment for you. I mean, I don't know what it means. I will do what I did on Judge Bork. I'll wait until the committee process has completed its hearings entirely.
Some Republican lawmakers have called the revelation embarrassing. Senator James McClure said if the administration knew about Ginsburg's drug use before, he would not have been nominated. An Iranian gunboat attacked a U.S.-owned tanker in the Persian Gulf today. The tanker was fully loaded with Kuwaiti oil. There are no reports of injuries or an oil spill. Shortly after the attack, Iraqi warplanes bombed Iran's main petrochemical complex. The Reagan administration has reversed its position and decided to sell Stinger anti-aircraft missiles to Chad. The Defense Department says Chad needs the missiles to defend against air attacks from Libya. Spokesman Keith Snyder said the sale is a complete package, including training. Democratic Senator Dennis DeConcini is one of the major opponents of Stinger sales to Africa and the Middle East. He said today he's very concerned about the lack of safeguards to prevent the missiles from falling into the wrong hands. White House and congressional negotiators say they're making some progress on budget reduction talks. House Republican leader Bob Michael presented a proposal today that would cut the deficit by $75 billion over 2 years. But House Majority Leader Thomas Foley said that Michael's package is just one of many proposals under consideration.
I think there's way too much focus on a particular proposal here. This proposal, no more than the Domenici proposal, no more than the Gray Childs proposal, is a final or semi-final or that sort of thing. That, if you've been given that sense, I think that's wrong.
Negotiators have been bargaining for 2 weeks to try to reduce the deficit by $23 billion next year. The unemployment rate went up to 6% last month. It's the first increase in more than a year. Economists say the slight upturn in the jobless rate indicates that the U.S. economy is so strong that it may have been slowed but not stopped by the October 19th stock market crash. Brazil and its creditors announced a deal today which could end the country's moratorium on foreign debt payments. Brazil owes more than $110 billion, and today's agreement may end its isolation from the financial world. Richard House reports from Sao Paulo.
An agreement sealed in New York early today and announced by Brazil's chief creditor, Citicorp, brings to an end a 9-month moratorium on interest payments that had threatened American banks with losses of $7 billion. Brazil agreed to make an immediate $500 million down payment to escape being classified as a bad debtor by a Washington regulatory committee that had set today as its deadline. The banks wanted Brazil simply to abandon its moratorium and accept economic controls from the International Monetary Fund in exchange for new financial aid. The resulting agreement is a face-saving measure for both sides, but the feeling is that the banks have the better end of the deal. For National Public Radio, this is Richard House in Sao Paulo.
U.S. and Mexican officials signed a trade agreement today designed to arbitrate disputes between the two countries and promote greater commerce, but it is unlikely to reduce the large U.S. trade deficit with Mexico. The agreement is officially called an understanding. It says either party may request consultations with the other about trade issues. Such consultations must be held within 30 days. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 26 points to finish at 1959.05. Advances led declines by 13 issues. I'm Lori Waffenschmidt, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Singer and guitarist Bob Brosman joins us today for our weekly performance spot. He's going to play a couple of songs that were popular in the 20s. The kind of guitar he plays is one you don't often hear.
Well, now I'm going to be accompanying myself on an old National steel guitar. That's a resonator instrument that's mechanically amplified, kind of the transition between acoustic and electric instruments. They only were popular for a few years in the late 1920s, quickly superseded by the electrics, thus paving the way for culture as we know it today. Now I'm attracted to the music of the 1920s because of the sincerity factor and also the syncopation factor. I'd like to start out with a little song here by Pink Anderson, who was a medicine show performer from the 1920s in the rural traditions of the South. And the song I'm going to play for you is a little number about a few folks with one thing in common. They all wound up in the jailhouse. And as I talk to you here calmly, you'll be a little surprised when I start singing because I'm singing in the exuberant style that was so popular back then. He's in the jailhouse now.
Once had a friend named Campbell. Old Campbell used to steal and gamble. He made his living cheating at cards. He had a little game called Yoker. It was blackjack, dice, and poker. He thought he was the smartest dude around. I found out last Monday, yes, Campbell got locked up Sunday, man, and they got him in the jailhouse way downtown. Old Campbell locked away in jail, nobody gonna go his bail. That judge just said he would accept no fine. He's in that jailhouse now. He's in that jailhouse now. Well, I told Campbell once or twice, quit messing with cards and shooting dice. He's in that jailhouse now. I remember last election, all the folks there was in action, trying to elect themselves a president. Look what we got. Here come my brother by the name of Bill Austin. He walked from New York to Boston, trying to get an honest sentiment. Well, my brother Bill's a voter. He's a big promoter. He's always looking for some good advice. They said, Bill, just go to the poll and vote across a Republican row. But instead of once, that fool, he voted twice. He's in that jailhouse now. He's in that jailhouse now. Well, I told Bill to go his own, just leave those politicians alone. He's in that jailhouse now. Play that thing. Friday, Lord, I met a little girl called Ivy, and I thought she was the cutest little gal in town. I'm beginning to spend my money. She began to call me honey. We stepped into a cafe to sit down. I was getting in it, spending every minute. Buying that woman prize liquor by the quart, wasn't by the pint. When it came a time to pay the man, I found that lady's head right in my pocket where my money was. She's in that graveyard now. She's in that graveyard. Now you know I told that judge right to his face. The lady's hand was out of place. Well, she's in that graveyard now. Pushing up daisies and I am in. Oh, yeah. Oh, daddy's in that jailhouse now.
From the urban tradition of songwriting, we have a real typical New York character in Walter Donaldson, one of the better-known Tin Pan Alley composers. Some of his bigger hits were My Blue Heaven, Makin' Whoopee, Little White Lies, Love Me or Leave Me, and the song I'd like to play for you in a minute here, You're Driving Me Crazy. Donaldson was a pretty prolific guy. He wrote hundreds of tunes. In fact, a lot of them were written on the spot. And he was a kind of guy that spent a lot of time at the racetrack chomping on a cigar, and sometimes he would dash off these tunes without a piano just to cover his bets. And I'd like to tell you that through the wonders of modern recording science, I'll be cloning myself on two rhythm guitars and one Hawaiian guitar, creating a quartet with the vocal, all with yours truly stomping away. You're Driving Me Crazy.
Do, honey, what did I do? My tears for you make everything hazy. Cloud in the skies, cloud in the skies are blue. Oh, how true were the friends who were near me? Believe me, they checked me, it's true. But you were the one who would hurt me, desert me when I needed you. Yes, you. Driving me crazy. What did I do? Oh Lord, what did I do to you?
Bob Brosman's latest album, Hello Central, Give Me Dr. Jazz, is on the Rounder label. This is Fresh Air. My guest is rock singer, songwriter, and guitarist Marshall Crenshaw. His latest album, his fourth, is Mary Jean and Nine Others. Crenshaw is a favorite of many rock critics and has a devoted following, yet he's never had a hit single or achieved mainstream success. This summer, Crenshaw played Buddy Holly in the movie La Bamba. Crenshaw grew up in Detroit listening to Buddy Holly, R&B, the Everly Brothers, and Eddie Cochran.
I honestly did get interested in rock and roll when I was a child. My father was a big rock and roll fan. My dad also likes country music and anything with a beat, you know, anything that's kind of down to earth, he likes. And that's the kind of music I always heard at home.
So they weren't yelling at you to grow up and listen to Steve and Edie Gourmet?
No, I never got that. I mean, I got yelled at about a lot of things, but that wasn't one of them.
Your brother Robert is the drummer in your group. Have you been playing together since childhood?
No, my brother and I have been working together just over the last 6 or 7 years.
So how did you get together playing?
What happened was he got out of high school and he immediately got into a band that was making money. And I just kind of like, you know, I got real interested because I was in a rock band, like a local rock band in Detroit. And we were trying to play our own songs, you know, and be a bar band at the same time, and it was just a complete failure.
Rock radio has gotten pretty tightly formatted. Do you get a lot of play on rock radio stations around the country?
I don't think I do, no. I don't listen to very many of them, so I can't say firsthand, but no, as far as I know, I don't get, you know, I get little, if any. I think there are a lot of things out there on the radio that are real comparable to what I do. I just have an individual slant on it, I think.
Mary Jean, Mary Jean, Mary Jean.
recently played the role of Buddy Holly in the film La Bamba. You had been compared to Buddy Holly by some listeners and rock critics when you started performing. How did you get the part in the film?
Well, it was real undeliberate on my part. I didn't know anything about the fact that they were making a movie about Ritchie Valens. I never would have guessed that anybody would make a movie about Ritchie Valens. And I also wasn't really pursuing film roles or anything like that. It was just a classic kind of a thing. You know, I picked up the phone and it was Hollywood on the other end. And the fellow on the phone was Taylor Hackford, who was the producer of the film. And, he started telling me about La Bamba and asking me if I wanted to play Buddy Holly. And I kind of said, oh, yeah, here we go again, you know.
What were your reservations?
Well, my first reservation was that I didn't think I could pull it off, you know. I didn't think I could get up in front of a camera and pretend to be someone else and actually do it, you know, with a straight face. But he talked me into it, you know. He said, at least read the script before you make a decision. So he sent me the thing. I got it the next day. And as soon as I read it, I really got interested in it.
Greil Marcus, the rock critic, praised you for portraying Buddy Holly as a hipster.
Yeah, I know.
Were you consciously thinking of that?
No, not at all. I was trying, you know, as best as I could, I was trying to come off like I was, you know, Buddy Holly from Lubbock, Texas, you know.
I think one of the great ironies in your career is this. Buddy Holly was one of the people who really influenced the Beatles. They named themselves after Holly's group, the Crickets. And you actually played not only Buddy Holly in La Bamba, but you were one of the stars of Beatlemania in the West Coast tour, I think. And you played the part of John Lennon.
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. Well, I was in the... I know, it is really like a marvelous coincidence.
Yeah.
Because if I had to, you know, if I had to make a list of my top 10 favorite musicians and childhood heroes and stuff like that, those guys would be tied for first place, you know, battling it out, John Lennon and Buddy Holly.
I should say, for our listeners who don't remember Beatlemania, that how did they bill it? Not the real thing, but an amazing facsimile?
Yeah, this is embarrassing. Actually, Beatlemania was this really silly thing. It was a really big hit for a while, but I don't know. When I first heard about it, I was appalled. There was this big spread in Time magazine, and it was these guys dressed up as the Beatles, you know, and I just thought, this is ridiculous, you know, this is so exploitative and phony and stuff. But then later on, when they offered me a job, you know, I kind of threw my ethics out the window, because I needed the money, you know, that's the truth.
How long did you do it?
Just shy of 2 years.
When you got out of Beatlemania and you started making it on your own, under your own name, did you go through a period of almost being embarrassed to tell people that you'd been in the show?
Well, I figured it, I thought of it like, I read Merle Haggard's autobiography, and he said that when he first started his career, after he'd had a couple records out, he decided to reveal to the public that he'd been in San Quentin on death row, because he figured that eventually people would find out anyway and perhaps try and use it against him. So I always, you know, I was always upfront about having been in Beatlemania for the same kind of reason.
Are you hungry for big success in your career? Do you know what I mean? The kind of stadium concert type affair? Or do you think that you'd rather keep things at a more moderate proportion? I mean, not as the kind of thing you could decide anyways, but...
God, you know, I really don't know. I haven't got that sorted out. I mean, I'm definitely ambitious, no question about it. But, I don't know, that doesn't completely get it either, you know, because really the kind of shows I like to play are, I like to play where there are lots of people who love us. You know, I mean, that's like the only criterion. So I guess if there's 1,000 of them, that's cool. But then if there were 100,000 of them, boy, that would really be cool.
1, 2, 3. Forget what I
Last question. During your career, you played John Lennon in Beatlemania, you played Buddy Holly in La Bamba. Do you think that, like if someone was playing Marshall Crenshaw, do you think of yourself as having an identifiable style in the way that, the people you played do? It's really hard to judge that kind of thing for yourself.
Yeah, well, I think we definitely have an identifiable sound, without a doubt. I can't define exactly what it is, or I won't, you know, I won't try to describe it, because you're right, I'm too close to it to do that. But yeah, I'm real certain about that. I think that is that I've always admired people who were stylists, you know, who as soon as you heard like two or three notes, you knew it was them. And yeah, I'll stand up and say that about us. You know, I think that if you hear a few seconds of one of our things, you can tell it's us. You know, I think that's at least one thing we have going for us.
Marshall Crenshaw, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Cool.
Marshall Crenshaw's latest album, Mary Jean and Nine Others, is on Warner Records. Next week, he'll perform in Richmond and Norfolk, Virginia, and Asbury Park, New Jersey. Thanks to WIOQ Radio in Philadelphia for the tape of Marshall Crenshaw in concert. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne co-hosts the program, and she's joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, Terry, yesterday, Supreme Court nominee Douglas Ginsburg admitted he'd used marijuana several times during his college years and in the early 70s. Today, we're going to be reporting on new revelations that may hurt Ginsburg's chances for confirmation. Also, I speak to Anthony Masters, who's author of Literary Agents. That's a book taking a look at the spy careers of a number of very well-known British writers. Now, John le Carré is somebody you probably know was a spy, but you may not know that Somerset Maugham and Graham Greene both did stints as spooks.
They were recruited as spies?
Yes, indeed, they were.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic Ken Tucker has a review of some new home videos targeted for the younger set. One's a music video that's not MTV, and the others are based on nursery rhymes.
Chances are, if you have a child under the age of 10 in your house, you know Raffy. He's the gentle voice singer who makes records for children that even adults can enjoy. If you don't have a preteen, you may be interested to know that such a person exists, someone who's built a career out of entertaining children without the aid of TV fame. Raffy has been around for a decade, but he recently released his first video cassette. It's called A Young Children's Concert with Raffy. It's a real charmer, and if you don't know about Raffy, it's a perfect introduction to him.
Yeah. We've got a hot crowd here today. You know what? There was once a very weird store. Very strange store that stood on the corner. And all kinds of things happened in it. There was cheese, cheese, walking on its knees in the store. In the store, there was cheese, cheese, walking on its knees in the corner grocery store. Well, there were plums, plums, twiddling their thumbs in the store. In the store, there were plums, plums, twiddling their thumbs in the corner grocery store. My eyes are dim, I cannot see. I have not brought my specs with me. I have not brought my specs with me. Oh, it sounds like a choir in here.
As that excerpt suggests, Raffi is not Pee-wee Herman. He rarely raises his voice above a murmur. While his songs are gloriously silly, my 2-year-old is hooked on one that contains the couplet Willoughby Wallaby Wee and Elephant Sat on Me. The songs are tuneful and well played. This video is a model of its kind. The camera is there simply to record Raffi's performance and his interaction with a group of young children. There are no special effects, no flashy editing to make Raffi look like a hero. His record company bills him as the Bruce Springsteen of the tiny set, but that's dead wrong. Raffi is entirely self-effacing. He told me in an interview a few months ago that he wasn't even sure he wanted to make a video of his show, because he thinks his young audience should experience his performance in the flesh. Kids see enough TV, he told me. Why should I add to the reasons they stay glued to the box? Now there's a sentiment you won't even hear from Mr. Rogers. There are lots of other kids' videos floating around the marketplace these days, and I feel duty-bound to mention one of the most popular. There are now 4 volumes of the Mother Goose Treasury in video stores. These cassettes retell nursery rhymes like Jack Be Nimble and Old King Cole, using actors to dramatize the stories. I hate these videos. They're filmed on cheap-looking videotape, and the acting has all the subtlety of the Three Stooges. But the 2 little critics in my house love them, and so apparently do many other little critics. Buyer beware. Other new video releases include Spalding Gray's Swimming to Cambodia, which in its one-on-one directness is sort of Raffi for grown-ups. There's also Jour de Fête, Jacques Tati's glorious 1948 comedy that will convulse both adults and children.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with rock critic Real Marcus. He edited a new collection of pieces by his friend and fellow rock critic Lester Bangs, who died in 1982 after a life of frenzied writing and hard living. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the new album by the trio Power Tools, and television critic David Bianculli will comment on the state of the docudrama. So I hope you can join us. We'd love to hear from you. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show was produced by Fred Landerl, Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.